Welcome to episode 2 of the Jung Depth Psychology Podcast. It's your friendly neighborhood host, Harry Venice. And today we're going to be looking at Immanuel Kant and Carl Jung. This is going to be a short introduction into Kant and Jung and some of the similarities, how Jung was influenced by Kant, some of the similar words used and adopted, and also just some similarities in the approaches and how Jung's, the way he structured his psychology and how that was influenced by Kant. Kant is very difficult to read. In the next couple of episodes, we're going to have a Kant focus because I believe it's very important that there is some understanding of Kant before we dive into Jung. Because as Jung said in a famous interview, he said that he was steeped in Kant. And steeped, think of what steeping is. You steep tea leaves in water to infuse the flavor of the leaves in the water. You steep it, they become enmeshed. The flavor imparts on the water. We think of water as the unconscious. Jung steeped his mind in Kant. This is very important. And that's why, if you're wondering, hey, this is a Jung podcast, a psychology podcast, why am I talking about Immanuel Kant and philosophy? And why did you start with Nietzsche on the last episode? This is the reason why. Because you need the fundamentals. And Edward Edinger, a famous Jungian analyst and author, he said, you got to have a basic grip of some philosophy, just a basic amount to get Jung. And that's what I'm providing here in the first few episodes. So we're going to be having a chat about Kant in the next 3 episodes. They're shorter episodes. And it's just to get that idea and that basic understanding. So they're not that long. They're interesting. They're a bit intellectual. But stick around, and it's going to help you get within your own depths of your own mind and to know how to view categories and science and psychology and philosophy and your relation to the world. On that note, I'm going to cut now to episode 2 and the originally recorded audio because, as I said, the first 5 episodes were recorded with a different mic. They were just for video only. So we're going to get into it, and I hope you enjoy it. Today I'm going to talk about Immanuel Kant and his critique of pure reason. I'm not going to focus so much on the book. I'm just going to generally speak about Kant. I'll just plot him here next to that awesome book, Warriors of the Rainbow. I'm just displaying that. It's a Native American book on mythology and their dreams. And it's worth checking out. I got it at a secondhand bookstore. Now, quite a contrast back to Kant, or Kant, however you want to call it. I mix it up. In the next video I'll make, I'll talk more specifically about how he approaches human reason. And that's part of that book, The Critique of Pure Reason. Today, I just want to sort of freestyle and think what comes into my head when I think of depth psychology, Jungian psychology, Carl Jung, and Kant. Famously, in an interview, Jung said he was, quote, steeped in Kant. So he's important. That means that he influenced his thoughts and his mind. As someone who's read a lot of Jung, studied it, I'm in training to be an analyst, I'm doing the core components of analysis and training. What comes to my mind? First of all, there are words used. Objective, for objective psyche. Kant uses objective. He talks about the noumenal and phenomena, or phenomenon.
Jung talks about phenomena and noumenos, which means something different. I don't want to get too caught up in these words. Just giving you some examples. What else comes into my mind? What Jung, the way Jung categorizes things, a priori, that's the one, from the Latin. Now, a priori, things that exist a priori, are fundamental to Kant's philosophy. And for Jung, he says the unconscious, the collective unconscious is something that exists a priori. I don't want to get too technical again because it's going to complicate things. And then it'll have me not making these videos properly and reading from a set list. And I don't want to do that. I want to cut to the chase. But essentially, I say that to cover the loopholes that can exist but from what I state. But essentially, things exist a priori. They're as a given, okay? There are some things in the world, in life, that we just have as a given thing. And for Jung, that would be, for example, the collective unconscious, the unconscious mind, specifically the collective unconscious and archetypal contents. We are born with those. So Jung adapts that from Kant, that term. There's all sorts of messy lineages and other philosophers using these terms, but we're just going to keep it simple. So this terms, categories. So Kant says there's limits to human reason and human knowledge and empiricism. Things that are beyond our tools of perception, our sense organs. You know, we're limited by the tool we have or tools as human beings. And, you know, empiricism, broadly speaking, is, you know, knowledge based on experience or observation. Things that are real to us that we can quantify. But what Kant says is, how can I put this? There are things beyond empiricism we can't account for in human reason. And I'll get into that in the next video. So just bear with me. Don't worry about it for now. There are things beyond that. And then he has categories. And he categorizes things. That's something also I'd say is common with Jung. The way Jung approaches constructing his psychology is very Kantian in that sense. He's trying to be scientific and account for things. So that's another link with Kant and Jung. It shows in the way he writes his work that he is influenced by Kant and reason and limits of human sense perception. And it brings me to my final point that I don't really notice anyone talking about for some reason, but it's really struck me, is the Archimedean point. Now, that's obviously linked to Archimedes. And I mean, he's a genius in his own right and fascinating stories with the bathtub and, you know, he had to solve something for a king. But this comes up a fair bit with Jung, and it's totally overlooked in psychological discussions. It's very convenient in modern psychology and just generally this empirical focus that seems to assume we know more than we do. I mean, and that's what Kant is getting at, is there are limits to the sense organs and what we know. Socrates said, I know that I know nothing. He clearly knew a lot, but the Socratic method of questioning people, if you do that, you piss a lot of people off. But it's not a great way to communicate if you want to make friends. And Socrates did piss a lot of people off. But you can, rather than arguing with someone, you can ask questions and you can show, you know, the flaws. or the limits in the logic. And if you adopt a Kantian thought, you realize the limits of your own knowledge and your own sense perception. And that links into the Archimedean point, which is, you know, the idea of the perfect vantage point outside of something. So if you have the psyche here, I mean, Jung repeatedly emphasizes this, that it's the psyche studying the psyche. He himself is limited by that. I am, you are. There's a limitation. And the Archimedean point would be having a point outside of the psyche and looking at it. The perfect vantage point. Now, I've looked at this. I wrote a thesis recently, you know, a master's thesis, and I tried to infuse the Archimedean point, and there's some criticisms of it. They say it's unrealistic to have the perfect vantage point when studying something. This is the psyche, for example. But it's the idea of the Archimedean point that matters, rather than one existing. It probably doesn't exist for anything. But Jung always says, when you study the psyche, you're limited by the psyche. It's the psyche studying itself. When I study the psyche, I'm studying the psyche, my own mind. And it's constantly happening that I'm bumping into walls. I have biases. I'm studying this thing, but then my unconscious mind and my repressed contents are sabotaging my ability to see the truth. I might use the theory itself to, in a self-serving way, in an argument where I'm really projecting things like that. But it also applies from a more scientific point, that how can it be truly objective if the psyche is studying the psyche? And that, to me, you know, I've got the critique of reason. I don't have as much time as I want to dedicate to him in a primary source, primary book reading sense. But I've read a lot of secondary sources and listened to very learned people talk about him. And from what I gather, and from the bits I've read, it's very infused in Jung's approach. And it's important, not just for understanding Jung, but understanding yourself and the world we're in. Because I really think, at least for me, it opened my eyes to all the assumptions that I've made and do make. And I've really peeled that back now, you know. And part of that is your sense perception. And that's another thing. Jung, I'm going to link Kant to Jung now. Jung is a lot about sense perception in typology, for example, but you know, intuition, sense. These things come from words from Kant and just even the vibe of reading it. It's, you absorb that. And Jung has a very heavy focus on sense perception. Intuition is another one. And I forget the gentleman's name, this professor, but he emphasized that even how intuition was translated from the German in Kant, you know, perhaps it would have been ideal that it wasn't translated into the English as intuition. You know, I don't intuit that it's a lovely day. You know, some example like that is used. But intuition is something that Jung also latches onto and uses. So that's pretty much what I want to say about Kant and Jung. It's very relaxed and off the cuff. What I'll add is, let me think, I wanted to add one thing. Yes, a more just general way this Kantian thinking can help. An example is the garden, the rose garden, and something about the color yellow. And there are exceptions, the human eye can view in a certain range of, I believe, yellow, and then the bee can see beyond that, something like that. It's, the colors are relevant. But the bottom line is, when the human is in that garden, the sense perception of the eye can only see the colour to a certain degree, and the bee can see a greater spectrum or another colour. The key there is, who's right? Who's seeing a fantasy? Who's seeing a reality? Well, they're both seeing what they're seeing, but they've both got different tools for seeing that limit them. And when you're going to be an investigator of truth, of an argument, you really need to be aware of that. And I'll be quite honest, on a really deep level, I was not until I was studying Kant and, you know, then relating that to how I view psychology generally and Jung. And, you know, Jung, you got to give him credit. He really acknowledges these limitations. I generally don't notice people acknowledging limitations like these generally. It's not taught in school. You'd have to go on your own rabbit hole. But the real genius thinkers are fully aware of this. And especially in the modern science realm, you know, people are spouting out statistics, numbers, and categories. That's something I also want to talk about. When you use a term, you're categorizing something. This is now getting into Kantian thought. We live in a world of chaos. We've got to order things. There's lights on now as I'm filming this. There's a microphone. My mind has to order this disorder, put it together. We do the same with psychological categories. You know, ironically, they're called disorders in the modern vernacular. You know, someone's got a psychological disorder. Well, that's really trying to order the disorder of the psyche, put them into categories. Now, it's very dangerous categorizing people, and I'm not going to get into that today. But if you look at something like the DSM, what it's doing, if you apply Kantian thought, is it's trying to categorize, it's trying to order the disorder within the mind and order people, put them into boxes. Without any terms or categories, I mean, it's just chaos. We need to order things. But it's very important to be aware that that's what's going on. And then when you apply a Kantian thought, you start questioning, okay, where does this term come from? The DSM, from memory, was first published in 1952. It had Freudian terms in it. A lot of things that are now removed, were they not valid then? Were they valid then? Someone called you some term there and it's not existing anymore. Who's the barometer of that? You know, science changes. Now we're getting into Piagetian, you know, thinking. You know, he focused on that, that, you know, showing that even though he's labeled a developmental psychologist, Jean Piaget was really about showing how science changes, and he looked at him, I think himself, I forget the term, some sort of almost a biologist or epistemologist. I don't know what the term is. I'm just going for it. But it's Piagetian in that way where he says knowledge changes. He spent a lot of time on that, showing that it's needed, there's progress and things change. Yes, that's part of it, but it's dangerous to not understand that they're man-made categories. And what makes it true? You know, especially when we're getting into DSM stuff, you know, what makes it true? Yeah, all modalities are trying to order things. But we should be aware that these are categories, is the point, and the limits of human knowledge, and the danger of categorizing people. You know, this, because depending on your own state of mind and your own projection, you know, it's very seductive to categorize someone that's hurt you. You know, narcissism's a great one. And, That's defined interestingly in the DSM. We won't even go there. But it's very, very attractive when someone displaying those traits, because there's a reason that category and order, disorder or ordering of a disorder exist. It's a cluster of traits of grandiosity and very self-absorbed view of the world. And they do certain things. People that embody that cluster of traits, there is a modus operandi. So if you've suffered from someone who has those traits or has inflicted upon you the negative elements of those traits, it's very, very attractive when you're when you haven't processed it or in the process of dealing with the behavior like that, to throw that term on and hang on. It can be very helpful to get strength to move beyond it. But we get into dangerous territory with categorizations, you know. Hopefully I totally did not plan what I was going to say now, because I like to go off the cuff, and I'll let you know when I'm more organized in that sense. You know, I want to enjoy this and I want it to be real. You know, I don't want to make it a presentation. So that's all that's floating in my head when I think of Kant. I love that we got into a mention of Piaget. I never would have assumed that would happen. Immanuel Kant, Critique of Pure Reason. I'll get into that into the next video, and that's going to break down page one, which is interesting. Let that float in your head, and until next time, I'll see you around.